Wake up, all you American dreamers.
My name's Leah Clark, and I'm from Rochester, Michigan. And I just think that people are going to start to see through this American dream.
Goodness gracious, my generation's lost. They burned down all our bridges before we had a chance to cross. Is it the winter of our discontent, or just an early frost?
Maybe things that make you feel really alive that you can spend your money on for a house.
Baby boomers had it all.
I'm in my mid-20s, and a lot of my friends are spending all of their money on their house, and they feel trapped. And I think that the younger generation is going to start to see through this.
Goodness gracious, my grandma used to say, the world's a scary place now, things were different in her day. What horrors will be commonplace when my hair starts to gray?
The 21st century American dream, see-through or impenetrable wall. All this week on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 10th. All right, I admit it. I'm John Hockenberry. I am a baby boomer.
I'm Farai Chidea. I guess I'm a Gen Xer. I'm in for Adora Udoji, who's on leave with her new baby. Coming up this hour, a conversation about unemployment benefits. We hope that you don't have to sign up. Just in case, we'll explain how to make sure you get every dollar you deserve. Also, how the wheeling, dealing, and earmarking of the budget affects you. These stories and more ahead, but first, these headlines.
At least 28 dead in Iraq after a suicide bombing attack on tribal leaders west of Baghdad today. Dozens more are wounded. This comes 2 days after another blast killed 30 people. Vice President Joe Biden is talking about Afghanistan with NATO allies. He's in Brussels to talk about America's planned shift in strategy there. He says he's open to suggestions from partners. The Obama administration is already sending 17,000 more American troops to Afghanistan. We'll have a conversation on what the Obama policy is going to be right after the headline.
And today, education is the focus for President Obama. He'll explain the first steps of a plan to change schools in a speech later this morning. Changes in the air for union workers at Ford as well. The United Auto Workers accepted a deal to freeze their wages and cut benefits.
And an oil surge on an OPEC production cut has caused an oil surge on world markets. There are also new developments roiling the markets in a military squabble between China and the United States. The Dow and S&P lost about 1% yesterday. They open upward, at least according to the futures trading. The S&P begins trading at 676. As we mentioned at the top of the hour, we're going to be talking all this week about the new American dream. We had a listener, Leah Clark, who says it used to mean owning a house, but that's no longer the case. Some of you had different thoughts.
I believe the government has to continue its efforts and maybe up the efforts to make sure we can complete the dream, that is to buy a home, to work hard, and to retire in dignity.
What of the American dream is still in force? Give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Retiring in dignity, simply surviving the recession. We've heard all of those things already from you. Let's hear some more. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. This is no American dream. This is actual reality. This is The Takeaway. You are awake, but we are interested in your thoughts on the American dream in the 21st century at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Farai today is with me here in the studios, filling
delighted.
In for Adora Udoji. That's right. You have thoughts on the American dream.
Many.
You're a living example of the American dream, as am I.
Yes. Child of an immigrant, child of an American.
There we go. Much to talk about there, and we'll be looking for your comments later on in the program. But did you see that movie, Charlie Wilson's War?
What is U.S. strategy in Afghanistan?
Well, strictly speaking, we don't have one, but we're working hard on that.
Who's we?
Me and three other guys.
The movie Charlie Wilson's War was set in the Reagan administration, where three guys and the CIA director came up with the Afghanistan policy that became a lot of what we see in Afghanistan today. But today, the three other guys are much more high profile in the administration. Vice President Biden is in Brussels today asking NATO for more troops to send to Afghanistan. 17,000 more of its forces in the coming months will go there. Yesterday, the commander of U.S. and NATO-led forces in Afghanistan, General David McKiernan, said the U.S. and NATO are not winning the fight against Taliban insurgents in large parts of the south of the country. On Sunday, President Obama himself, in a New York Times interview, admitted that the coalition is not winning in Afghanistan, and he hinted that his administration might talk to moderate elements of the Taliban. Is Afghanistan at the center of U.S. policy? Well, listen for yourself.
Part of the success in Iraq involved reaching out to people that we would consider to be Islamic fundamentalists, but who were willing to work with us because they had been completely alienated by the tactics of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. There may be some comparable opportunities in Afghanistan.
It's President Obama on Air Force One talking to New York Times reporters in a special briefing on Friday, March 6th. That, of course, was last Friday. Joining us now is Art Keller, a former case officer with the CIA, who has an op-ed piece in the New York Times today. Comparable opportunities in Afghanistan to talk with moderate elements of the Taliban. Art Keller, first of all, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And secondly, do you think there are opportunities to talk with the Taliban? And what do you make of the 17,000 man surge in Afghanistan? Is this the kind of tactic that's going to win the so-called war against terror and the Taliban in the relatively lawless area of Afghanistan outside of Kabul?
Well, in theory, I think both are positive developments. Certainly, they're a step in the right direction. Of course, you know, there's a thousand ways it could not pan out. But people have been saying for quite a while, who've examined the matter pretty closely, that we just did not have enough troops on the ground to provide stability, which would allow space for reconstruction aid. And reconstruction is kind of one of the fundamentals of counterinsurgency work, to win over the locals. So the additional troops are definitely needed for stability, and I do believe that there are some people in the Taliban that could be persuaded, people whose primary motivation is not religious. There were has been a lot of ill will generated by overuse of air power and other things, and people who have joined for economic rather than religious reasons. So those are the kind of people who, you know, if we play our cards right, can hopefully be won back.
Well, let's take a look at the cards. The air power in Afghanistan, which we've used quite a lot in the NATO offensive over there, is, according to your experience, and you've written about this, not necessarily a good card to play in a counterinsurgency campaign. Why?
Well, I once read a counterinsurgency expert, I don't recall his name now, once said the ideal counterinsurgency weapon is a knife. And that's because in order to effectively employ a knife, you have to know who you want to attack, and you have to be within arm's reach. You have to know the community well enough to know who to go after. So that's why air power, because even with precision weapons, it can be indiscriminate. And the tale of people bombing wedding parties, unfortunately, things like that do happen from time to time. It's a common tradition for people there to fire guns in the air during wedding parties. Well, people who don't know that have inadvertently from time to time bombed wedding parties because they thought they were taking fire from hostiles. But more than that, just war is a very uncertain business. And if you get bad intelligence and act on it, you know, and you're using a 500-pound bomb, well, you can take out a lot of innocent people. And, you know, local allies have not been above the practice of saying, hey, American friends, you know, this compound is full of bad guys. And later we find out that the compound was not full of bad guys. It was full of that person's personal enemies.
No, that sort of retribution thing has been very, very well documented, right?
Yeah, I'm just wondering how this relates to particularly the issue of the border with Pakistan. I know you have quite a bit of experience with Pakistan, but the U.S. has been using the Predator drones to work against insurgents in Pakistan, people who travel back and forth, who are Taliban-affiliated, if not Taliban themselves. It sounds like you're arguing for precision. What do you think of the Predator drone program in that light?
Well, my secrecy agreements kind of prohibit me from commenting too extensively on that. In general, I can say, it's come out in the press that I think at least eight major Taliban leaders have been removed in the last 6 months through the use of Predator strikes. While we've been singularly unsuccessful at getting number one or number two, the number three position of Al-Qaeda is one that is an oft-vacated position and is not one I would personally want to hold.
Well,
because,
yeah.
The U.S. has been fairly successful in cooperation with allies in tracking down and kind of keeping the mid-level people on the run.
But on the question of keeping the community in support of what NATO is doing, if all you're doing is Predator drones, the counterinsurgency effort really works against the presence of more troops in Afghanistan on the political level. What are the lessons from, say, the Vietnam era in getting the, it's such an overused term, hearts and minds of the people of Afghanistan on board to some sort of civic nation building that would be independent of the Taliban?
Yeah, well, I addressed this in my op-ed, and I draw some comparisons, some parallels back to Laos. It so happens as when I was graduating from CIA training, they brought in an old legend to talk to us, and this was a gentleman called Bill Lair, who had run the CIA's covert action in Laos.
Remind people that, of course, in the Vietnam era, Cambodia and Laos were involved. Laos and Cambodia are neighbors to Vietnam, and there were insurgency campaigns both by the Viet Cong and by the United States in both Cambodia and Laos. And Bill Lair was responsible for Laos, correct?
Yes, he was. And, while a mid-level CIA officer, he had at one point had 30,000 native troops under him, as well as a whole air wing to call on. So he had more troops than most generals these days. And, the effort that he started at first went really well, and that was even though he had a lot working against him, local people were extremely primitive by our standards. They didn't have any sort of a system of reading or writing. They didn't have the wheel even. But the key to Bill's success was that he had a group of people that he had trained, Thai police, who, were ethnically similar, who spoke the language, and who were the ideal people to help train the Hmong tribesmen into effective guerrilla campaigners. And so a lot of the same challenges that obtained in Laos then, corruption, drug running, undereducated people, obtain in Afghanistan now. And, Bill's greatest success was that he used the right people in a culturally appropriate context to train those people. And so that is a lesson that we need to embrace today. The 17,000 additional troops may be needed to stabilize the country, but in order to build up the forces of the locals to run the country and to take on the insurgency, the Taliban insurgency themselves.
So keep your eye on the locals. That's a great takeaway. R.R. Keller, former case officer with the CIA, has an op-ed in the New York Times today. Culturally appropriate work on the ground, covert ops in Afghanistan. It's a policy we have yet to see in the Obama administration. Fry?
Thanks, John. We're talking this week about the American dream. What does it mean to you?
My American dream is just to be approved for school loans, for college loans.
And we also got an email from Johnny Sue, who wrote that her 12-year-old daughter had a conversation. Her daughter said that the American dream did not exist. Johnny Sue said, "The dream is what you make it. What makes it American is the freedom to pursue it." Let us know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Great email.
Yeah, beautiful.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
My mind on my money, money on my mind. If you owe me $10, you ain't giving me $9. Y'all ain't give me 40 acres in the mule. So I got my Glock 40, now I'm cool.
40 acres, a mule, and a Glock. What's your idea about the American dream? Is it like Jay-Z's, or does it mean something different to you?
My American dream was to travel around when I was fresh out of high school, actually, and just to go around, put a backpack on, and see the world. You don't need a car, you don't need much money, and you don't need anything that you can't fit in your backpack.
American dreams, low cost or otherwise. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Fry today is in for Adora Udoji. Fry?
Well, President Obama says he's open to ideas from both parties when it comes to the budget. Members of Congress are taking him at his word and taking a red pen to his beautiful budget. New York Times National Desk correspondent Jackie Collins has been tracking the key players in the budget game, and she has a front page article in today's paper. Morning, Jackie.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. So, you know, who's waving the bossy stick here and trying to trying to change the budget? Give us a couple of examples.
Well, the biggest example so far is the fact that President Obama has proposed a limit on the deductions that the wealthiest taxpayers in the top two tax brackets can take. And that would raise roughly $30 billion a year, which would cover about fully half of the cost of this reserve fund that he would like to set up to help finance and pay for the changes in health care policy that eventually would produce cost savings in health, but right now need some upfront investments in order to see those savings. And so it's a major deal, because without this, they have to find some other way to help pay for his health care changes. And what it would do is limit the deductions to 28%. And right now, the people in the top two brackets could take a 33 or 35% deduction. So the administration is pushing back. And another one is in farm subsidies. You know, people in Congress want President Obama to reduce the deficits, but then those in farm states say, no, not with farm subsidies. So you've got that down the line.
And that's Democratic pushback.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm very interested that Representative Charlie Rangel of New York is one of the people who is, you know, he's often seen as, you know, a New York liberal, moderate, you know,
right,
somewhere on that spectrum. But he's pushing back against this idea of letting there be a phase out of the tax issues, the lowering of the taxes on wealthier Americans that happened during the Bush era. Why do you think, you know, the one thing that comes around a lot in this discussion is, well, rich people won't give money if their mm-hmm. taxes go up. Is this the basis of the argument in general from people who are in this camp?
Well, this is the argument they cite, that if you limit the deductions, one of the deductions is for charitable giving, and that will dry up. The administration says, no, that it affects only very few taxpayers, and it's not like they're zeroing out the deduction for charitable giving. They're just saying it's at 28%. So, for instance, if you're in the top tax brackets and you give $100 to a charity, you can deduct $28 of that instead of $33 or $35. In Charlie Rangel's case, this is less an issue of charitable deductions than it is parochial politics. And I don't say that in a pejorative way. New York is one of the states with the highest tax burdens in the country, state and local taxes, income taxes, and you also can deduct those. So for New Yorkers, a limit on deductions is a pretty big deal.
And
if you're a rich New Yorker.
It's a real issue for Charlie Rangel in his reelection. This is a casting issue as well as it is a kind of a numbers game, talking about subsidies and things. Who are the gatekeepers? Who are the people we need to watch in terms of names, committee leaders, as this budget battle moves forward? And we're really just at the beginning of this.
Yeah. Well, at the beginning, the two leaders, gatekeepers, are the House and Senate budget chairman. That's John Spratt of South Carolina in the House, Kent Conrad of North Dakota in the Senate. But the more important than them even are the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Charlie Rangel, and in the Senate, the Senate Finance Committee chairman, Max Baucus of Montana. And the reason they are so important is because the Ways and Means and the Finance Committees have such a broad jurisdiction that they are responsible or share responsibility for tax policy, health care policy through Medicare and Medicaid, and trade policy, Social Security. So it just is the committees that are octopi, whatever, with their tentacles into everything.
Well, when you think about what happened with the spending bill, what do we have to look ahead to with this administration grappling with Congress? I mean, a lot of people thought, okay, you've got a Democrat in the White House, Democratic House and Senate. We've been seeing a lot of partisan wrangling, but also there is, you know, as John pointed out, some pushback from Democrats.
Right.
What do we have to look forward to?
Well, I think that you're going to see, you know, with the cost, the downside of having such big majorities as Democrats have is that you have more more diverse group of people with broader interests, and that they're going to push for those interests occasionally. You raise a good point with this spending bill. Right now on the floor of the Congress, we have this $410 billion appropriations bill for this current fiscal year that people didn't really expect to be a problem. And here you have the thing has hung up on one senator's objection to a proposal that would open travel and trade to Cuba more than it has been. This is Senator Menendez of New Jersey, who's a son of Cuban immigrants. And he not only that, he's a member of the Senate Democratic leadership, which normally would toe the line. But this issue is so important to him and his constituency and to constituencies in Florida that he's, you know, basically delayed this passage of this bill for days. And if a member of the Senate leadership is willing to do that over one provision in this bill, it doesn't bode well for the coming very contentious legislation ahead on health and energy.
Well, thanks, Jackie. And my guest was Jackie Combs, New York Times National Desk correspondent. Now we have Femi Oke with the news.
Hello there. Good morning. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. These are the stories we're following this morning. President Barack Obama will give the first details of his education plan to the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. He will speak about new approaches to helping students and teachers. Vice President Joe Biden is asking NATO members today to put up a joint front to Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups in Afghanistan. Biden spoke from Brussels. And at least 14 are dead after a suicide bomb attack on a Sri Lankan mosque, and many more were injured, including a government minister. More on all these stories later in the program.
And suicide bombing in Iraq, 33 dead?
That's right, so
thanks,
far.
Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Faraj Dea, sitting in for Adora Udoji. We are talking this week about the American dream. What does it mean to you? Well, Chris wrote in, if this is the American dream, I'd like to be woken up immediately. So maybe it's a question of the American nightmare, but we want to know what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
So dream or nightmare, you feeling a little flat on your back? Well,
starting today, we must pick ourselves up,
pick yourself up,
dust ourselves off,
dust yourself off,
and begin again the work of remaking America.
Start all over again.
First you don't succeed. Dust yourself off and try again.
We've been dusting ourselves off all week on The Takeaway. Easy for the president to say. He's president, right? But in fact, if you're trying to deal with an impending layoff or the economic stress in this environment, it may feel like a grueling presidential campaign even to get out of bed in the morning. President Obama addressed the stresses for Americans in his first primetime press conference.
If there's anyone out there who still doesn't believe this constitutes a full-blown crisis, I suggest speaking to one of the millions of Americans whose lives have been turned upside down because they don't know where their next paycheck is coming from.
So if you are facing an impending layoff, if you are looking for this economic downturn as a change in your status as far as employment is concerned, you're going to want to listen to Andrew Stettner, who joins us. He's deputy director of the National Employment Law Project. And Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
First of all, if you discover that you're either on the slate to be laid off or have actually received a pink slip, you sort of need a committee of advocates to figure out what the next step is, right?
Yeah, I think you're going to have to be prepared to advocate for yourself. Most people have never gone through something like this, have never asked for help before. And there's help available, but you have to work to get it, probably as hard as you've worked on your job.
So you're facing unemployment. There are benefits to think about, and there are unemployment insurance benefits that the state will give you that are also available to you. How do you go about making sure you preserve the maximum of both of those?
Well, I think these are benefits that you've paid into. The states are dealing with a huge rush of claims, so it's going to take you a while to apply and get them. And I think you want to make sure that if your employer tries to play some games with you that say, well, you should quit or take a buyout, you have to really think very carefully because you could lose eligibility for unemployment benefits. In a state like New York with an average of $400 a week with more than a year of benefits, that's $20,000. That could come to you. So you don't want to take any action that might make you lose that help.
Yeah, I'm going to just put my business out in the street, Andrew, which is that I was laid off and then I also left my job before the end of the sort of phase out of my position. And I did that after researching things. And as it turns out, once I was laid off, that was a termination. And so when I left, as long as I gave 2 weeks' notice, didn't really matter. But a lot of people were confused by it, including HR, because they didn't really understand I was still, or at least I won't say just HR. I think the different people we're unclear on the rules here, and I had to do a lot of research myself. I mean, do you think that in cases that are slightly complicated, it pays to just ask and re-ask and double-check? I mean, I was, like, talking to the union, talking to HR, talking to, friends who had legal degrees. It was kind of complicated.
It is. I think that particular situation is very complicated. If there's a situation where your plant is closing and you want to leave before they close the doors, it really is going to depend on what state you live in.
Really?
So I think it's something that you need to do carefully. And in a number of states, you'll be okay. But in some, especially if you take a buyout, you may lose your eligibility for unemployment benefits. And the suggestion there is a good one. You can try to talk to the Department of Labor, or you can try to, reach out to some free legal services and get some legal advice. It's something that is a pretty easy question to answer in each state. It's just hard to answer it, how it's going to be in every state, because the state laws vary a little bit.
There's a financial incentive for employers to try to cobble together a case that maybe you were a non-performing employee and that you're not actually laid off. You're being let go. You're being fired, essentially. What are the defenses for workers who find themselves in that situation?
If you're fired for poor performance, you're still eligible for unemployment benefits if you're fired for misconduct, breaking a rule, or breaking the law, then you're not eligible for unemployment. So you want to be, you know, they could concoct that you're breaking a rule, you know, even if you didn't know about the rule, you know, they haven't documented that you've broken the rule. So, you know, force them to really, you know, make sure that they provide documentation. Tell the truth, and if you do get denied unemployment benefits, take it to a hearing and present the evidence, and you should get back on the rolls.
I mean, I'd hate the case to be that you played solitaire on the website and you got nailed for non-performance and lost unemployment as a result, Farai.
Well, you know, I'm fascinated by this this COBRA subsidy. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's for health care, right?
Yeah.
So basically, there's in the stimulus bill, the federal government is now going to pick up 65% of your COBRA benefits, which are the continuation of health coverage that you pay the premium that your employer was paying. So now if you elect to do COBRA, you only have to pay 35%. And, you know, it should be pretty seamless. You should be getting soon notices from your company or from the insurance carrier of this option, and you can start paying that 35%. I think the thing that's important to know is that you need to elect COBRA in general within 60 days of your termination. There's going to be some, you know, some leeway for people that didn't know about this provision, but going forward, you got 60 days to elect COBRA after you if you're laid off.
Healthcare and unemployment insurance, all really important issues if you're facing a layoff. Andrew Stettner, Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project. Thanks for illuminating those details, Andrew.
You're welcome.
All the information will be on our website, including more information from the National Employment Law Project. And Femi Okeh has the headlines. Femi?
Hello there, John. Thank you very much. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. There's been more violence in the Middle East today. The Iraqi military says as many as 33 people are dead and many more wounded in a suicide bombing attack. The military says the bomber detonated an explosive vest as tribal leaders toured a market in the town of Abu Ghraib. This comes in the wake of a suicide attack. United Auto Workers have agreed to a new deal with Ford to keep the automaker solvent. The company says it has enough cash to survive the downturn, but the concessions will help offset slumping car sales. Nearly 60% of workers voted to accept the deal, freezing pay and cutting benefits. Ford is the first U.S. car company to reach such an accord with its union. GM and Chrysler want a similar deal. Accused multi-billion dollar fraud artist Bernie Madoff is in court today.
Boy, they could sell tickets for that.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Would you go?
I would go,
right,
sure.
Great. He must testify on whether his attorney has a conflict of interest. His lawyer's late father once had an account with Madoff's firm. Madoff wants to keep his attorney, but a federal judge will have the final say. And the International Monetary Fund warns that the entire world economy will likely shrink this year, and they're calling it a great recession. That's a look at some big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Was it a question of nautical harassment? The Defense Department says that Chinese ships confronted a U.S. ship mapping the ocean floor. For its part, the Chinese government is accusing the U.S. Navy of breaking international and Chinese law. Quentin Somerville's with us. He is a BBC correspondent in Beijing. So, Quentin, can you explain exactly what happened?
Well, there was a U.S. surveillance vessel in the waters about 75 nautical miles south of the Chinese tropical island of Hainan. That's according to the Pentagon. And at some point, while it was surveying using sonar equipment, it was approached and then harassed by at least five Chinese vessels. One of them was a People's Liberation Army naval vessel. Then a couple were with various other government agencies, and then two were from shipping trawlers. And they started harassing the U.S. vessel. They moved close to it. At one point, within 25 feet, they forced the U.S. Navy vessel to a dead stop. And then they started attacking its sonar equipment with long poles. Then things take a bit of a curious turn because the Impeccable, the U.S. vessel, was unarmed. They then turned their water cannon on the Chinese crew of one of the vessels, who stripped to their underwear and kept approaching, or at least their ship kept approaching. Now, there have been a number of these encounters in the South China Sea. They're increasing in regularity, and it just gives a flavour of some of the military tension in this part of the waters just off China.
Now, when you think about a case like this, what do we know about international law? Did the U.S. Navy ship break international law?
Well, I'm not an international maritime lawyer, and the law on these matters is always a little bit vague. China says it has an exclusive economic zone which runs 200 miles off its coast. Now, that's allowed under UN maritime law. But where it gets difficult is when other nations encroach on that area. And this area, this whole South China Sea, is riddled with disputes. Malaysia has claims on certain islands. The Philippines has disputes with the Chinese over certain islands. Japan has disputes. So the sovereignty of these waters isn't clear. But perhaps what is clear is that these vessels didn't behave in what you consider a responsible manner. Not all of them were Chinese naval vessels. They brought in some Chinese-flagged trawlers as well.
Right.
And there's a wider point, really, here, in that relations between China and the U.S. are pretty good right now. Hillary Clinton, when she was here in Beijing, gave China quite an easy ride of things. But as China increases its military spending, it inevitably will begin to attack the hegemony of the United States in this region, particularly its naval power. So China's spending a fortune there. There's a secret naval base being built on the island of Hainan. So all of that creates a bit of tension.
Right, not much of a secret. Quentin, I don't want to go beyond your expertise, but does stripping to your underwear on deck constitute an escalation in maritime tradition? Maybe a technical question there.
Well, I was at a Chinese foreign ministry briefing today, and I did want to ask them whether that was standard operating procedure for the People's Liberation Army Navy, but I held back on that. And you're absolutely right. That naval base isn't much of a secret, except if you're in China, because the Chinese government haven't admitted it, and Chinese people don't know it's being built. Independent experts tell us it's happening.
Well, thanks, Quentin. I'm just thinking maybe they're trying out to be underwear models. That was Quentin Somerville, BBC correspondent in Beijing.
Fashion or international incident?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. 50 years after the incident that began the Tibetan exile of the Dalai Lama, what does it mean? We'll talk about that with Nick Kristoff of our partners, The New York Times, right after Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. As many as 33 people are dead and dozens more wounded in a suicide bombing west of Baghdad today. The attack targeted tribal leaders touring a market town in the town of Abu Ghraib. It's the latest violence amid a drawing down of U.S. forces there. Violence is escalating in Northern Ireland. Gunmen killed a policeman there, and this comes just 2 days after an IRA dissident group killed two British soldiers. The group, known as the Real IRA, opposes the 1998 peace deal between Catholics and Protestants. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown spoke out against the group's recent attacks.
The Real IRA have no place in the politics of Northern Ireland. These are callous murderers. These are terrorists who showed no sympathy towards people who were dying.
The three killings this week in Northern Ireland are the first of their kind in more than a decade. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is urging House Democrats to be patient as the Obama administration tries to fix the economy. He met with lawmakers in a closed-door meeting last night. Members of Congress urged him to hurry. Union workers at Ford have agreed to contract changes in a bid to help the automaker stay competitive. The new deal includes a wage freeze and benefit cuts, and the company says it has enough cash to survive the downturn, but the concession will help offset slumping car sales. And finally, NASA has cleared the Space Shuttle Discovery for launch tomorrow. On board will be Japan's first astronaut, Koichi Wakata. Japan is celebrating this will be the first time they've put a man in space.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
And now, today is the 50th anniversary of the Tibetan uprising that forced the Dalai Lama's Tibet spiritual leader into exile.
Things are still going on very badly inside Tibet. That, unfortunately, after 50 years, still basically the same way. And in some cases, even worse.
That's the Dalai Lama speaking to the BBC. And some of the unrest that we saw 50 years ago, there were some very brutal hints of. As China was preparing for the Olympics, there were monk-led protests and some deadly anti-China riots in the Tibetan capital of Lhasa. Joining us to talk about the significance of the 50th anniversary and how it is a legacy both for Chinese rule and also for the Dalai Lama's attempt to lead the country into some form of independence is Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times. He joins us by phone. Nicholas, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
What are your thoughts this 50th anniversary? Because it's a very troubled legacy on both sides, it seems to me.
I think it's incredibly depressing that there really have been times in the past few decades when it looked like there might be an attempt to resolve this. But these days, both sides are farther apart. After the Dalai Lama dies, I think it'll be rather more difficult ever to resolve this. And I think each side is making some real miscalculations that will make it that will just increase the problems within Tibet for the Tibetan people.
What are the pro-independence groups' miscalculations, in your view, including the Dalai Lama's?
I think that their problem, in my view, I have enormous sympathy for what they're going through, but that they've miscalculated where their constituency is. And the Dalai Lama has won enormous international legitimacy, and rightfully so, but at the expense of any legitimacy within China and among the Chinese people. And the fact is that the constituency that really matters to a lot of the Tibetan people within Tibet are those Chinese. And I don't think he's done as good a job reaching out to within China to the ordinary population and also to the leaders, and missed a few opportunities earlier on. In recent years, I think he's tried harder to overcome that. But at the end of the day, what is desperately needed is some kind of an agreement between the Dalai Lama and the Chinese government that would give more autonomy to Tibetans, more religious freedom, and would most importantly check the flow of the Chinese population, the Han Chinese population, into Tibet. And conversely, what the Chinese have catastrophically miscalculated is that they think that it's going to be easier to deal with these issues when the Dalai Lama dies. And I know, in contrast, he's been a huge restraining force on Tibetans. You talk to young Tibetans, and the main thing between them and a much more violent approach is their enormous faith in the Dalai Lama.
Well, when it comes to the question of the Dalai Lama, there are many different spiritual leaders that come out of Tibet, and some of them disagree with the Dalai Lama on various points of how this debate over sovereignty should be negotiated. Is there truly, from the U.S. perspective and the Chinese perspective, only a discourse with the Dalai Lama, or are there other people involved that represent the interests of Tibet?
He's the only one who has broad legitimacy among the Tibetan people. I mean, there are other factions and other groups, but he is genuinely revered by the entire Tibetan population. And I think he's the only one who could deliver the kind of concessions that would be necessary. So there are other leaders. I mean, one of the other constraints is that the number two spiritual leader is the Panchen Lama, and China has effectively kidnapped the Panchen right. Lama because it was somebody that they didn't like, and so they now have a fake Panchen Lama whom they are raising, and the real one vanished as a small child.
Well, this constituency inside China seems to be the key, and you raise a great point that the Dalai Lama can have as many lunches as he wants with Brad Pitt and Richard Gere and Steven Spielberg and all the celebrities in the world, but unless you have a foothold in the sort of mentality of the Chinese people, forget about it. And I'm wondering, as the recession takes hold in China, is that even going to be more difficult to get the attention of people in China as the agenda shifts to things like stimulus packages and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think it is. And the unrest a year ago was a real milestone in that, in causing resentment among the Chinese population. Before that, people often didn't have really strong views, but these film clips of Han Chinese being attacked by Tibetans within Tibet just aroused enormous anger. And if you ask Chinese almost anywhere around the country, they'll say, "No, we spent millions and millions of yuan trying to develop Tibet. We've dramatically improved the quality of life there." And then they come and attack civilians, tourists walking around Lhasa. And I mean, that is a very widely held perspective. And a lot of ordinary Chinese think that the Chinese government has been too soft on Tibetans, while, you know, in fact, talk to any Tibetan and they tell you that the absolute opposite, that China may have done some development, but that's only to steal Tibetan resources. The government has been enormously repressive. And, you know, the two sides are just farther apart than ever.
Well, as you've written many times in the past, there's a tendency always to think that, you know, China might be opening at a time like this where there's a new administration, but one need only look to Hillary Clinton's recent trip to Asia. Tibet is not on the top of the U.S. agenda. Nick Kristof, as we look back over 50 years, the trends are not good. Thanks for helping us with that.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times talking about the 50th anniversary of the uprising that caused the Dalai Lama to be exiled from Tibet. They'll be celebrating it today. We're talking all this week about the new American dream. What does it mean to you?
John from Dartmouth, Massachusetts. The American dream to me, freedom to be you and me.
Hi, this is Eric from New Jersey, and I think that the new American dream is simply surviving.
Hi, this is David from Providence, Rhode Island. The American dream is a nightmare for some of us.
The American dream is overrated. This is Raquelita from Miami, Florida. They foreclosed on my house. The real estate broker and the mortgage broker is still living and making money. I have no home and no job.
Wow, we are really hearing from people. People are pouring themselves out on this one. I think it's really, it's on everyone's mind. I also want to mention, Jamara wrote us on our website. She says, the American dream has always been just a dream for so many people. Now with the recession, more people understand how an institution can strip you of an opportunity to earn a livable wage almost instantly.
Jamara goes on to say, we can no longer just blame individuals for their inability to manifest the so-called American dream. This recession has been humbling because we finally know that poverty can happen to anyone. No one is exempt. That sounds like a nightmare. You know, survival was what one person said when they called 8778-MY-TAKE. They said, surviving this recession, that's my American dream. Let us know what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The 21st century American dream is what we're talking about all week long on The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Good morning, Leah Clark.
Hello.
We heard from you last week talking about all your friends and they're financially trapped in their houses that they bought during the housing boom. It seems like, from what you told us, you didn't go there.
No, I didn't.
And for you, being debt-free looks pretty smart.
It does.
And is that the new American dream? No financial commitments, not being tied to a house, some land, a piece of America? Is that it for you?
It is for me. I would love to live off the grid and not rely on any electrical companies to provide me with the things that I need, like power.
Hmm. So a long time ago, you know, millions of new Americans moved west and homesteaded on land given away by the federal government. If you were to homestead today, where would it be, Leah?
I would choose California. Right now, California has a lot of sustainable housing options, such as prefabricated houses, that I would be interested in purchasing and then converting to use off the grid.
The land, of course, isn't free, is it, Leah?
No.
40 acres, hold the mule. Getting beyond the old American dream. Maybe it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 10th. Our listener, Leah Clark, really started something. She's from Rochester, Michigan. We're talking about the American dream all week long. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji. She's away spending time with her new baby. Coming up in a moment, the Supreme Court rules on voting rights, and some folks fear it could set back diversity among elected leaders. We'll explain, plus later this hour, how DNA fingerprinting is giving wild animals a break. All this and more ahead, but first, we've got your headlines.
Two Washington stories top the news. Ben Bernanke wants an overhaul of the entire financial regulatory system rather than monitoring individual components like bank and rating agencies. He spoke to the Council on Foreign Relations. And today, President Obama will outline a plan to cut dropout rates and put in tougher standards for teachers, his education program.
Looking overseas, Vice President Joe Biden is talking about Afghanistan with NATO allies. He's in Brussels discussing America's planned shift in strategy, and he says he's open to suggestions from partners.
What we want to learn is what your countries believe are working, what you think is not working.
I'm going to do one line.
How we can do a better job in stopping Afghanistan and Pakistan from being the haven for terrorists.
And so the administration is already sending 17,000 more American troops to Afghanistan.
Thanks, Farai. U.S.-China military relations are tense. Chinese say an American mapping ship was operating illegally in the South China Sea. The Pentagon says Chinese ships harassed the American vessel. Hell on Earth, that's how the exiled leader, the Dalai Lama, describes Tibet under Chinese rule. His remarks come on the 50th anniversary of the failed Tibetan rebellion. Change is in the air for union workers at Ford. The UAW accepted a deal to freeze wages and cut benefits. The Dow and S&P lost 1% yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 676. The American dream?
This is Don from Providence, Rhode Island. Call me a high school English teacher. I am. But there's no better statement of the American dream still than the Great Gatsby. It may be tawdry, but you could be whatever you want to be and make yourself whatever you want to make yourself.
Update Gatsby on 877-8-MY-TAKE at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. My co-host this week is Farai Chidea and for Adora Udoji.
Hello.
We've also got two great guests here to talk about the 5-4 split decision from the Supreme Court yesterday, which actually narrows the scope of the historic Voting Rights Act. It's a technical decision. We're going to get to all of the details, but it's also important for two reasons. One, because the Voting Rights Act is so important. Here's Lyndon Johnson talking about the Voting Rights Act back in March of 1965.
Its object is to open the city of hope to all people of all races, because all Americans just must have the right to vote, and we are going to give them that right.
But any change in the Voting Rights Act is also significant because this, as a census year, is also a year when states begin to reapportion congressional districts. And the strategies for reapportioning are very, very important because they determine the representation of various groups and communities all over the United States. And we begin there with our discussion of this Supreme Court case. Nathaniel Personally, professor of law and political science at Columbia Law School. Nate is our pal and has been in the studio many times. And joining us for the first time is Richard Pildes, New York University law professor from a little farther down on the 4-5 train, co-director of the NYU Center on Law and Security. And you, I gather, are in favor of this Supreme Court decision's narrowing. And Nate, I gather you sort of argue against what the Supreme Court decided.
Well, I should say I filed a brief on behalf of neither party in the case, trying to take, you know, advocate the perspective of the political scientists and those of us who draw redistricting plans.
All right, we'll go
and
from...
I should also say I haven't actually taken a position on the case.
All right, fine. Fine. But I do understand that there is a slightly divergent. We'll get to the divergence in your views. But, Richard, first of all, explain technically what is this narrowing and what is the doctrine that's really being modified here or that the court decided not to extend?
Well, the best way to understand this problem is that it arises in a very different context than Lyndon Johnson was talking about in 1965. So here in North Carolina, you had an election district that had a 39% black population that was still electing black candidates because enough white voters were prepared to vote for the black candidate.
And there's a technical name, legal name, for a 39% minority population in a community like this. What is it?
This is called a coalition district, or the Supreme Court now calls it a crossover district, but it's not the traditional safe minority district, which usually meant a district that was majority minority, majority African American, majority Hispanic. So we're now in an age in which districts that are not majority black or Hispanic still can elect black and Hispanic office holders in some circumstances. And the question is,
by creating a coalition with other groups.
By creating a coalition with other groups, including with white voters who, as we just saw in the November election, are much more willing to vote for African-American candidates than they used to be.
So, Nate, how would the Voting Rights Act be a strategy or a mechanism to help communities like that in the reapportionment process?
Well, a lot of communities look to the redistricting process in order to enhance their representation in Congress and state legislatures. Usually that means, or historically, when you're talking about the Voting Rights Act, it means the creation of these districts where minorities could constitute a voting majority in the districts. And the question in this case was, could they also maybe have a legal entitlement to certain districts where there were less than 50%? And the court said no.
You know, Nate, there's the question of what constitutes gerrymandering. Some people have said that the Voting Rights Act created, all these bizarrely shaped districts. Other folks say, hey, these bizarrely shaped districts happen all the time just to try to, keep incumbents in office. How does this play out with the general trend that incumbents in Congress, as the maps are drawn, have over a 90% chance of being reelected? How does race and the Voting Rights Act play into that big picture?
One of the differences between the Voting Rights Act today and when Johnson first initiated it is that we have a whole set of minority incumbents, in part because of the creation of a lot of these districts. And so they can defend their interests in the political process. And so a lot of them often want districts that aren't excessively overconcentrated in terms of the percentages of minorities, but ones that are closer to 50% or even under 50%. And that's the context in which this case comes up, which is, well, can you sometimes push down the minority percentages in these districts and spread minorities out more efficiently to gain a greater number of districts?
Is it fair to say that the court is essentially saying to this North Carolina district, hey, folks, you want to get elected, you need to attract the votes of a broad constituency in your district. We're not going to help you out using the Voting Rights Act to redistrict so it's more favorable to you.
There is that idea. I mean, both the majority and the dissent were trying to make an argument from the standpoint of racial neutrality, that what they were trying to say is, well, the dissenters were saying, look, we should allow these kind of 30% districts to have legal claims under the Voting Rights Act because then it'll enhance crossover and coalition building. The majority was saying, look, if we start giving a legal entitlement to these kinds of districts, then the effect is going to be you're going to always be thinking about the Voting Rights Act every time you're drawing a district, no matter how big the minority population is. Mm.
Richard, when you think about this case and them actually sort of setting a number parameter, a 50% number, Is there any flexibility, I guess is what I'm saying, in, you know, this ruling as to, you know, because in some areas there's a great amount of coalition building and in some there's none at all. I mean, do these laws ever reflect the tensions within certain communities or the variable differences in how race and politics play out?
Well, that's a great question because the situation today is so much more fluid and so much more complex than it used to be. You know, it used to be even 20 years ago, in many places, whites would vote for white candidates 90, 95%. Blacks would vote for black candidates in similar proportion. And that has changed in a variety of ways. Again, you know, we now have a situation where both the Democratic and the Republican parties are led by African Americans. So how the Voting Rights Act should apply, does apply in those circumstances, is very complicated. What the court's decision makes clear is that legislatures have a lot of flexibility still to draw these districts if they want to, or to draw different kinds of districts with different coalitions. But the Voting Rights Act doesn't require the kind of district that was being asked for here. That's all the decision really holds.
I mean, you know, if you take Farai's point and extend it to the extreme complexity, you could have a situation where, you know, because minorities don't automatically vote for a minority candidate, where there is a 55% minority constituency within a community, but because they traditionally vote 30-20 or, you know, 50-60 or something, they split their vote from candidate to candidate, you could create this Democratic coalition. Well, it's not, you know, they don't always vote for the minority, but there's enough of a sort of split that maybe we would want to, you know,
help out. It's a very, very difficult problem. And to go back to the Lyndon Johnson moment, right, which is one of the great moments of his presidency, the problem back then was essentially getting people the right to vote and get to the ballot box. When we talk about the Voting Rights Act today, most of the time that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the kinds of issues you are asking about. And so how the act ought to apply to the design of districts where we don't have monolithic black communities, we don't have monolithic Hispanic communities, we don't have monolithic white communities in the same way we did even 20 years ago, let alone 40 years ago, you know, puts enormous pressure on the statute and creates very, very difficult legal and policy problems.
Census is coming up, and I guess, Nate, I'll go to you. What do we see in general? I mean, this is just one aspect of how, you know, districts are drawn. But with the new census coming up, is there going to be a tough battle over reapportionment in general?
There will be. There always is. There'll be a battle between the states as to how many congressmen they get, and there'll be battles within states as to how to draw the districts. And I should say, just to go back to this point, you know, there's great diversity in the level of racially polarized voting in America. So you look, for example, at this last election, Barack Obama actually did worse than John Kerry in some of the Deep South states, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas. He actually did significantly worse than John Kerry. And then, of course, in places like Virginia and in North Carolina, he did significantly better among whites. And so it's you know, there's sort of different trends in different parts of the country. But we're going to see you know, redistricting is a quagmire. It's what keeps Rick and me in business. And you know,
it's counterintuitive for most Americans. I think when Americans look at their congressional district every 2 years, they go, "What the heck is that about?" It feels really anti-democratic, I think, to Americans, regardless of party.
Well, I want to go back to Farai's question. It's a horrible problem. It's really the much bigger problem here. We have, I think, a very unhealthy situation where politicians draw their own districts.
Do you think it's as big a problem, Nate?
Well, it tends to be that, you know, we think of democracy as voters choosing their electors or choosing their politicians. Actually, redistricting is more important. It's when politicians choose their voters.
Politicians choose their voters. That's exactly right.
No,
that's
no other country does it this way. It's a real, real pathology in our system.
Any chance the Supreme Court would get a challenge on this whole reapportionment issue in this critical census year? Yes or no?
No.
Ouch. Politicians choosing their own voters. Only in America, folks. Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia Law School, and Richard Pildes, New York University law professor, talking about the Supreme Court decision to narrow the landmark Voting Rights Act as reapportionment gets started once again. Thanks, guys.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
What's that I smell in the air? The American dream.
From Miss Saigon. Talk of the American dream. What does it mean to you, though?
I think that the American dream these days, just being able to afford retirement. I'm watching the retirement going down the tubes, and that's going to make us work a lot longer in order to be able to retire. Thanks.
So Broadway glitz or economic reality? Tell us about the American dream and how it's changed in this economic downturn. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Variety?
Well, sometimes the American dream was forged in hardship, and the Great Depression certainly was one of those times. And people put their shoulder to the wheel. They worked really hard. Here's a little bit of sound.
You may leave and go to Halifax, but my slow drag will bring you back. Well, you may go, but this will bring you back.
That was actually Zora Neale Hurston, the author of the famous novel Their Eyes Were Watching God, singing a field song as part of a federal Depression-era program to record folk traditions. It was called the WPA, part of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. Now, the New Deal turned the American government into an employer on a grand scale, and the economy improved. Not right off the bat, though. How did issues like racial equality fare? We've got Michael Dawson with us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and he says the New Deal might have reinforced some aspects of racial segregation. Explain that, Michael.
The New Deal had different types of effects on African Americans. As you mentioned, the WPA employed everybody from world-class authors to people working in forests and other places, which really helped African Americans. And so this, many of the relief programs helped particularly urban African Americans. But there are other programs that, particularly because of the influence of Southern legislators, either explicitly excluded African Americans, like Social Security programs, excluded categories of workers where blacks are overwhelmingly represented, like farmers and domestic workers, or in some cases, like the housing programs, explicitly excluded the benefits of those programs from African Americans. For example, the Home Owners Loan Corporation, which later became the FHA, invented redlining, thus banning federal loans, housing loans, to any neighborhood that had African Americans. So Social Security program and its racial exclusions, some of the problems with the agricultural programs and how they were administered by local officials in the South, and the housing programs all reinforced structural economic disadvantage for African Americans.
Let me ask you to drill down a little bit. Redlining is an issue that has come up a lot as people have looked at this whole mortgage crisis, and some people have even argued, you know, minorities have been more responsible for the mortgage crisis because they took out bad loans. Other people say, well, they took out bad loans because there's mortgage redlining. Explain the term redlining, first of all, and then how does it really date back to the New Deal?
Well, it dates back to the New Deal explicitly because neighborhoods were color-coded. Neighborhoods that had African Americans had a red code, and those neighborhoods were not eligible for federal loans. So that's where the word redlining comes from. Neighborhoods that, because of the presence of blacks, were no longer eligible for, or not ever eligible for, federal loans. Other types of exclusions, if you had Jewish or Catholic residents in a neighborhood, they also were disadvantaged, not to the same degree as neighborhoods with African Americans. So that's where the term redlining originated. And one of the things that happened meant that, one, it reinforced segregation because it made white residents even more unlikely to welcome black residents because it means they couldn't get loans either for their houses. Two, black neighborhoods often would deteriorate more quickly because they couldn't get loans to upgrade or to improve their housing stock.
You know, Professor Dawson, you raise an issue that I wonder if it's echoed in the current debate over the stimulus package. There's this tension between reforming America in the middle of crisis and forgetting about reform and just pouring money into essentially the status quo and reinforcing some bad decisions of the past. Do you see as that as what happened in the New Deal, and possibly there's an echo of that today?
Well, I think there's a little bit of an echo of that in the sense that because of our federal programs often get interpreted and implemented in different ways, or participation often is decided at the local level or the state level. So particularly during the New Deal, the South was a critical part of FDR's governing coalition and electoral coalition. He was not going to implement any policies, whether it was around the New Deal or around anti-lynching laws, that would jeopardize Southern support. Here, the situation, I think, is somewhat different. Particularly with the stimulus package, we were seeing the same thing that we saw with the Agricultural Assistance Act during the New Deal, that some Southern governors, particularly in states with very heavy black populations like Louisiana and Mississippi, are opting out of programs, or at least threatening to, in this case, particularly the unemployment aid, that would particularly benefit African-American citizens of those states, particularly in states like Louisiana and Mississippi, where we see black unemployment rates three times that of white. And, of course, Representative Clyburn was pointing this out and was immediately accused of playing the race card by some of these governors.
Well, let's take a look at what the positives of the New Deal were for African Americans. I mean, were there any in your mind?
Oh, I think the WPA and the relief programs are extremely positive for African Americans. As in most economic downturns, African Americans were harder hit than many other Americans, although America as a whole suffered greatly. So particularly in the urban programs really helped the working class and to some degree the middle class, as we pointed out earlier in the discussion. And that's why we see particularly the northern urban working class shifting to the Democratic Party for the first time during the New Deal. So, yes, the programs are quite, particularly in the short term, extremely helpful to urban African Americans.
Well, Michael, that was great. Thanks for giving us a broader perspective. That was Michael Dawson, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. And we have Femi Okeh with the news.
Thanks, Farai. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Let's start overseas, where at least 14 are dead after a suicide bomb attack on a Sri Lankan mosque. Many more were injured, including a government minister. Several high-level government officials were also there, and the government blames the Tamil Tiger rebels, though it has not admitted responsibility. There's more violence in Northern Ireland. Gunmen from an IRA dissident group killed a police officer last night, and it comes just 2 days after a similar attack killed two soldiers. Catholic and Protestant leaders have condemned the violence. I mentioned earlier that NASA has cleared the Space Shuttle Discovery for launch tomorrow, and on board will be Japan's first astronaut, Koichi Wakata. Now, let me just add a little detail to that story. Koichi Wakata will be the first Japanese astronaut who will stay on the International Space Station for an extended period of time.
There we go.
The reason I'm correcting that is because Cleverton Hockenberry over there raised his eyebrows when I did the story earlier.
I looked confused. I said, that can't be
Femi,
right.
You need to do more research. Come back later. See me in the corner. Thank you, Mr. Cleverington. You are right. I'm wrong. And they should have sent you to space.
Cleverington here. Yes. Maybe I am in space. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And And that was from the political satirical film Wag the Dog. And we're talking all this week about the new American dream. What does it mean to you? I'm Farai Chidea, by the way, sitting in for Adora Udoji. We've got Hal, who wrote on our website, it's the idea of the American dream that has been forced on us. A house, a car, and all the consumer goods that go with it that has caused the incredible ballooning of the market and the pop. We just don't need it. We get too caught up in the idea of achieving the American dream that we lose track of enjoying life. So we're going to be talking about this later in the hour, but right now is your chance to tell us what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE. What is the American dream? MyTake@thetakeaway.org.
They're enjoying a bit of a pop on Wall Street. Wall Street is open, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average opened a full 2% in the early going. In physics, there's a principle called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. We're going to do a little science now. Basically, when you observe the state of a system, you alter the state of the system. It's particularly true in biology, although Heisenberg wasn't a biologist. Here to talk about the problem of invasive tracking strategies for looking at animal populations is Jim Robbins, a freelance science writer who writes regularly for our partner, the New York Times. His piece about strategies for non-invasive animal tracking is in today's New York Times science section. Jim, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good morning.
What are the traditional tracking strategies and what are the new ones and how do they allow the system to be unaffected by the trackers?
Well, the old system, the system is still in use, they would go out and catch a wolverine, for example, or a bear in a trap and put a collar on it or put a little incision in its belly and put a transmitter in it, follow it with a radio tracker or from a satellite. And, of course, if you catch an animal and drug it and open it up and put something in it, it's kind of like a UFO abduction experience for an animal.
Yes, indeed. I mean, and it's invasive. And what is non-invasive tracking then?
Non-invasive tracking is to follow the animal without even seeing it sometimes, most times, and picking up its scat and taking that scat, collecting that, and maybe 20 or 30 other animals, taking it back to the lab and doing a DNA analysis on the scat and learning what that individual is like in terms of its genetic fingerprint. And then so you have a unique genetic fingerprint for each animal that you follow on the landscape, which may give you 15 or 20 samples rather than one or two from the animals that you might capture.
Now, you're talking to me from Helena, Montana, right?
I am.
So I suspect you've done some hiking in your day.
I've done some hiking, yes.
All right, so this is a combination of old-style tracking techniques of following animals in the wild combined with new DNA testing procedures to actually figure out who it is you're tracking.
That's right. You're out there on the landscape following these animals, learning where they live, whether they're spending their time and so on, as well as collecting their scat. And one of the nice things about this is for researchers, it's very much less expensive than the high-tech collars that might cost $4,000 or $5,000 and require a lot of staff time. So they can do a lot more of this. They can have volunteers help them, and they can just go out there and collect turds on the landscape, and they've got a pretty good idea of what's going on.
Collecting turds on the landscape.
Yes, we all have different things that are interesting about our jobs. I mean, this is fascinating to me because I am someone who really I grew up on nature shows and the whole idea of seeing, animal life. And then now with all of the debate over climate change, how that's affected. But I do wonder, do you have any disadvantages with this method? Aren't there certain things that it really does make sense to track by the more invasive techniques? What's the breakdown on that?
Well, if you use both together, the old and the new, you get a lot more information. So it does add to what's the traditional methods. One researcher I talked to, though, said, I got out here in this business to hold animals. He says, and this is picking up turds. He said, that's a big difference than what I was doing before. He says, I understand the need for the information. He says, but it's a change. But it does a lot of other things as well besides just give more information. For example, a lot of third world countries that want to do wildlife research, Pakistan, Bhutan, and so on, that have a lot of wildlife, this allows them to do it. They can't afford things like $4,000 or $5,000 collars and so on. So this is really an enabler for a lot of countries to look at what their wildlife are doing and to devise a conservation strategy.
Are the invasive techniques better for following the behavior of a single individual, or are invasive techniques better for determining the state of an entire population, a caribou herd, for instance?
Yeah, invasive methods are good for following one animal, knowing where that animal is every 20 or 30 minutes perhaps, or every hour or every 4 hours, because it's beaming its whereabouts up to a satellite and down to your computer. So, yes, for it goes deeper into that animal's behavior, but the non-invasive methods give you a bigger picture. And I should say it's not just picking up scat. I mean, there's cameras that are remotely tripped, and animals will, you know, we can tell whether there's an animal there on the landscape. A lot of researchers don't even know if the animal they're looking for is out there, and that gives them a way to look at that. There are a lot of other non-invasive methods out there. One of the Eurasian lynx researchers in Portugal will go into a cave and lay down cork, put Amazonian kissing bugs into holes in the cork, and then when the Eurasian lynx comes in and gives birth, those bugs come up, they bite that lynx, they take a blood sample and go back into the hole, and then the researchers come along later and collect those bugs.
Oh, that is too clever. My takeaway certainly is the UFO abduction analogy for invasive tracking methods for animals, that's for sure. Your piece in the New York Times Science Times is all about new non-invasive techniques that are a mix of the old and the new. Jim Robbins, freelance science writer for our partner, the New York Times, talking to us from Helena, Montana. And Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, good morning. Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke wants an overhaul of the nation's financial regulatory system. He says that changes should be made to strengthen oversight of the entire financial system, not just individual parts. And Bernanke says that new regulation would make global financial woes less frequent, less severe, but couldn't stop them altogether.
It is unrealistic to hope that financial crises can be entirely eliminated, especially while maintaining a dynamic and innovative financial system.
Markets are loving him this morning.
How are the markets doing, John?
The Dow's up more than 2%.
Okay, and they've just been open for what?
Yeah,
8 minutes or so,
yeah.
And well, the Fed chief was speaking to the Council on Foreign Relations this morning, and the Obama administration and Congress are starting to craft an overhaul plan. And moving on to Citigroup and profit. Now, you may not expect to hear those two words in the same sentence, but the bank's CEO says that Citi turned an operating profit in the first 2 months of the year. And he claims that the troubled bank's best performance since 2007. But the catch is that the profit comes before taxes and what businesses call special items. So those can include credit losses and write-downs of bad assets, which can reduce the profit. And Citi's stock recently dipped below $1 a share.
It's not because of all my ATM fees, I guess.
I don't think so. You don't go to the bank that much.
Not that much.
And that's a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And as Femi Oke has been reporting all morning, we're following the news out of Iraq this morning. A suicide bomb in Baghdad killed as many as 33 people, many of them Iraqi soldiers and Iraqi dignitaries on their way to a reconciliation conference. It's the second since Sunday to kill more than two dozen people. Joining us now is Alyssa Rubin, who's a New York Times correspondent, who we reached with some technical difficulty on the line from Baghdad. Alyssa, the targeting of dignitaries and tribal leaders, at least that's the understanding I have from some of the reports we're getting here, suggests this might be an opening salvo against people who were collaborators with the U.S. occupation forces during the surge period. Collaborators is a charged word, but what do you make of it?
Well, I would be cautious about that. It's pretty clear that the people who were walking through the market were members of the Iraqi military, and they were the target, although they were indeed on the way to a reconciliation meeting, and there were some tribal sheikhs with them as well. But it seems that this incident ended up at least killing or having as a chief target members of the Iraqi army, who of course also are viewed as collaborators of the Americans. But I'm not sure that it's the tribal chiefs per se in this case.
Right. Now, two data points does not a pattern make, but we do have two attacks now since Sunday. Is there any way of sketching out at least the possibility of some sort of tactical approach that insurgents are taking at this point?
Well, I think it's always difficult to say, but it is striking that both attacks were on a larger scale than ones we've seen, in the recent period anyway, and very close together. There have been sporadic attacks that have been have had quite high casualty levels, but these are very close together and a bit higher. And there actually was a third attack last week on a livestock market south of Baghdad.
Again, I know there's some sensitivity here on the sourcing, et cetera, but the Obama administration has been very, very upfront about pulling troops out, a drawdown, or lots of very public statements to the world that the U.S. commitment in Iraq is coming down. Is there any sense that military officials inside Iraq see these attacks as an answer to a very public policy by the Obama administration of signaling a downturn?
I have not gotten that sense from the military when I've talked to them, but I think what one does have to take into consideration are sort of two conflicting facts. One is that at the moment, very few Americans, relatively speaking, have left. It's roughly the same number as there were last week or in December. There's no significant change. But what the Americans have been doing over a long period, 6 months, 8 months, even more, is withdrawing from some of the bases, leaving combat outposts, turning those over to the Iraqi army, so that their public presence is much less evident. And their presence day to day, there were no Americans with this Iraqi army unit that was going to the reconciliation meeting. This was an Iraqi affair. And so to some extent, they are perhaps not as fortified as they were when the Americans
right.
were there.
Well, interesting points, and thanks for putting it all in perspective. Alyssa Rubin, New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. A bombing today killed as many as 33 people, most of them, many of them, Iraqi soldiers on their way to a reconciliation conference.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Where did the American dream come from anyway? Was it the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution? Did Abraham Lincoln come up with it, FDR? If you answered none of the above, you can collect your prize right after Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Good morning. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. We're waiting this morning for President Barack Obama. He's set to deliver a major address on education this hour. He's seeking higher standards for teachers and lower dropout rates for students. And the president will also be calling on Americans to educate themselves as well as their children. Vice President Joe Biden is talking about Afghanistan with NATO allies. He's in Brussels to talk about America's planned shift in strategy there, and he says he's open to suggestions from partners.
What we want to learn is what your countries believe are working, what you think is not working, how we can do a better job in stopping Afghanistan and Pakistan from being the haven for terrorists.
The vice president's visit to Europe is part of President Barack Obama's effort to engage NATO allies in global security discussions. And finally, the chairman of the Federal Reserve says the nation's financial regulatory system needs an overhaul. In a speech in Washington, D.C. this morning, Ben Bernanke says that stronger oversight is needed for banks, mutual funds and large financial institutions. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. Now let's do some American dreaming, shall we?
I have a dream.
What's happening to us?
The American dream.
A better way of life.
The great American
dream.
Don't tell me you don't know what that is. Okay, well, it's actually quite all right if you don't.
My piece of the American dream.
What everybody wants as they start out.
Securing your portion of the American dream.
In my American dream, the people do make a difference.
You seem to know what the American dream is. You've been calling us at 877-8-MYTAG.
American dream is definitely still around and still alive. There's plenty of people coming from outside this country and living in this country that are achieving the goals that they set out to achieve. However, the government, well, that's a whole different story.
On our website, Jamaica writes to us, the American dream is not about an unfettered trajectory into the financial stratosphere. It's about plotting our course to fashion innovative solutions to new challenges. Americans are scrappy, creative, and tenacious. Leah Clark from Rochester, Michigan, do you see what you've started here?
I'm excited about it.
Your speculation about the American dream being not what it used to be and that young people will be able to see through it has really caused some thought on the part of our listeners as well. Will you hold on there?
Yeah.
We're going to take a look at what the American dream actually represents down through history. And joining us, we have a great person to explain to us these arcs of history that you can hear in voices that are quite familiar.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
They called it Little Havana, where the American dream had a price tag.
A nagging fear that America's decline is inevitable, that the next generation must lower its sights.
From JFK to Scarface to Barack Obama speaking just last month, David Camp joins us. He has the cover story in Vanity Fair. He's the author of numerous books, including The United States of Arugula, the sun-dried, cold-pressed, dark-roasted, extra virgin story of the American food revolution. But the American dream is your subject in the current issue of Vanity Fair. And your article really spans the bit of history we played there. Where does the American dream come from?
Well, I had no idea, and it's funny, people just use this phrase so promiscuously and freely, and as we've heard from your listeners, everyone's got a different definition of it. So I thought, let's go to the source. And I was surprised to learn that this is a relatively recent coinage. It was only in the last Great Depression, 1931, that a historian named James Truslow Adams wrote a book called The Epic of America.
A
badly reviewed book, and it's kind of a weird subjective history of the United States. But the one very interesting thing he did was say, I'm going to get to the point of, you know, what is it that makes the United States unique vis-a-vis other countries? And he came up with this concept called the American dream.
Now, the starting point in the Depression was that the American dream was very abstract. It was a feeling. It was a sensibility. It wasn't necessarily a tangible acquisition of wealth at that point, was it?
No, it was much more about a sense of possibility and opportunity. It was about the freedom that this country gives its citizens and immigrants versus other countries, you know, where you're born into a sense of social hierarchy and class, and you must do the job that your father did, or you must live in the same place. And the United States was just, it was about possibility and opportunity, whether you were rich or whether you were poor, a level of opportunity and possibility that no other country offers.
You know, David, one of the things that really struck me about your article was the pictures. In addition to the text, you have these images, or the magazine has these images that run alongside it of what the American dream looked like to different people at different times. So you've got this, you know, prototypical white suburban family, and they're actually quite gorgeous, you know, 50s living room. Who participated in what we think of as the American dream, and who was left out?
Well, if we look at those pictures, what they were from Life magazine, and they were actually art directed by Norman Rockwell. They were, the photographers took those pictures, but Rockwell was actually on hand to direct them to make them look sort of like Rockwell paintings. And they are this sort of slightly antiseptic, idealized version of mid-century suburban life. And a lot of what you're seeing is sort of the idealized life that, you know, returning GIs took on in the mid-century when, you know, the first moment of the baby boom and economic prosperity. And yeah, it was a very white bread vision. Levittown, which is the idealized suburban tract of that era.
Tell the story of Bill Levitt. I mean, Levittown is named after him. He had a particular idea and really germinated the home ownership as a notion of having the American dream.
Yeah, because again, the American dream up until the post-war period didn't really have a specific material component to it. It was more an abstract ideal than a specific one. And Bill Levitt was this guy who came from a building family. He worked in the Pacific Theater building airfields very quickly, and he applied this know-how when he got back to these potato fields he'd bought in Long Island and decided to build suburban tract homes. And the GI Bill enabled returning GIs to have to buy homes for low-interest loans, no money down.
Especially white families.
Especially, yeah. There were no black families allowed in Levittown because Bill Levitt was a racist. But the idea, and then George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life, you remember, opens Bailey Park. He was a little more pluralistic and open. He brought Mr. Martini in, the grateful saloon keeper, the Italian immigrant, to open his, you know, to christen his development.
So from that point, then, and you can track the amount of American consumer debt from the 1940s to the 1970s, exploding. You know, the American dream becomes an acquisition of enormous outsized wealth, way beyond Levittown.
Well, I wouldn't say enormous and outsized up to the 70s. It seems like, you know, for all of the turbulence of the 60s and 70s, there was kind of a sweet spot where people, you know, were a little less overly cautious than they might have been in the immediate aftermath of the Depression, you know, and taking on debt, you know, to expand and pursue your dreams, whether it's opening a business or buying a home, getting a home loan, is not in and of itself a bad thing. It really only accelerated into kookiness really in the last two decades or so. So for all the weirdness we associate with the 70s, maybe that time was when the balance was best between thrift and borrowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David, we also still have Leah Clark with us from Rochester, Michigan. And Leah, you made this point that really got us going about how you didn't want what you thought the American dream was. But do you think that you're redefining the American dream?
I hope so. I think as a country that we can redefine what we think we need and what we think we have to have and really live according to our conscience, that maybe we don't need these, you know, large houses, that we can get something affordable, ideally sustainable, that's enough to live with and to not be in tons of debt and have it become a burden to us.
That's a great thought. David Camp, before we go, are Americans maybe the best definers of the American dream, or is it people outside the United States maybe?
Well, I think it's up to us to define what it means, and I think Leah's done an excellent job of doing it. What I say at the conclusion of my piece is very much like what Leah says. It's that I think we have to get away from this ridiculous idea that each generation must outpace and outlive standard of living-wise the next. And the phrase I say is, let's consider the idea of simple continuity, the perpetuation of a contented, sustainable, middle-class way of life where the standard of living remains happily constant from one generation to the next.
Something sustainable. David Camp from Vanity Fair, thanks so much for joining us. Leah Clark, will you live with continuity off the grid there?
I will try.
Thanks so much. We are talking all this week about the new American dream. What does it mean to you, and how has it changed throughout the course of this recession? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What does it mean to you?
This is Amy calling from Augusta, Georgia. I think we're all living the American dream, recession, depression or not. I think we all need to look at what's important and not, like a previous caller said, get caught up in having material goods.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.